Welcome to G&D Spotlight, the podcast where we shine a light on the ever-evolving world of security tech. I'm Jessica Antonacci, marketing for US Paytech, and today we are joined by G&D's Akshay Wariku and Dayan's Paul Kenny. Akshay is the global lead go-to-market for digital solutions at G&D, focusing on driving the global expansion of payment and banking solutions. An engineer turned go-to-market strategist, he specializes in product positioning, consumer psychology, sales enablement, and scalable growth strategies. He works cross-functionally to align product market fit, execute go-to-market strategies, and equip sales with high-impact narratives. At Dayan, Paul is focused on innovative identity solutions for both government and private sector programs. With over 20 years' experience at Dayan, Paul brings a wealth of knowledge and care to his role from a variety of identity programs worldwide. In addition to leading out delivery teams, Paul liaises with Dayan's customer support and product engineering teams to ensure they have a product which meets the needs of their customers to enable them to get maximum return on their investment. Today, we're talking about the identity landscape and how it is rapidly changing and what we can do about it. I'll now hand it over to Akshay.
Thanks, Jessica. So we'll get to the deepfakes, voice cloning, synthetic profiles in a moment. But first of all, let's start with your own identity, the kind even AI would have trouble faking. So like Jessica said, over 20 years of showing at Dayan, that's really remarkable. You've seen this space evolve from ground up. So what first drew you in the world of digital identity and what's keeping you so deeply invested all these years?
Thanks, Akshay. And thanks for the nice intro. So I've been working in this space for about 20 years now. Prior to that, I worked in middleware. And I suppose in working in that space, I felt a little bit disconnected from customers. And I wanted to get closer to customers. And when I discovered Dayan and the role that Dayan was playing in shaping digital identity, I felt that you couldn't get closer to customers than being involved in identity. And it's been a really interesting journey, working on programs from early days of more physical identity programs, I guess, with public sector and government, through to transitioning that into digital, and most recently working across both government, telco, and financial services in evolving digital identity and allowing people to transact online, represent themselves online, protect their assets, be able to prove who they are in interactions with organizations that they want to work with.
Oh, wonderful. And now, talking about identity, I came across an article recently detailing a U.S. investigation into black market platforms selling fake KYC-ready identities complete with deepfake videos for as little as $60. And these personas most likely were set to bypass both automated systems and human review across different platforms. And then in another case I was reading, identity thieves targeted death row inmates, individuals so disconnected from digital life that their identities could be hijacked and repurposed without notice. Now, Paul, you have worked with some of the world's leading institutions to keep trust intact in a time when it's never been more fragile. So from your vantage point, how has the nature of identity fraud evolved over the past 2-3 years?
Good question. I think the last 2 or 3 years, the main change that we have seen is the move from attackers trying to trick systems from the outside to them trying to trick systems from the inside and actually attacking the systems themselves to try and inject data or signals so that they can either masquerade as an individual or try and use a synthetic identity in a system. So I think that has probably been the big change. Instead of people trying to use the systems and input data into them, they're realizing that they were getting diminishing returns on that and instead are attacking the systems themselves.
Okay. So, I mean, now, at least to me, it feels like that fraudsters have really upgraded their tech stack and from the early days of digital pickpocketing, it's full-on identity engineering, and that makes me wonder, are we witnessing a shift from those stolen credentials to now, like you said, synthetic AI-generated identity?
Certainly, that is the risk that's out there, especially for identity programs that do not verify data that they receive. We always say trust but verify. So it's the same when you're getting data in an identity journey. You want to ascertain a trust in the information that you're getting from the individual, but then validating and verifying that information with other parties is a big part of preventing the synthetic identity, the threat of a synthetic identity in the system.
Right. And I think a few weeks ago, we were already speaking and you actually made a point that it's not that fraud did not exist earlier. It was there. But now there is this engine behind this generative AI. And you see in the identity world every now and then, what role is Gen AI playing in this new fraud wave?
So the role that Gen AI is playing is that it's doing two things. It's firstly lowering the barrier to entry for fraudsters to be able to generate artifacts. So previously to Gen AI, it would have taken someone with a reasonable amount of skill to maybe create these video artifacts that you mentioned earlier. You know, these videos of people doing things that they can try and input as data into the system, or generating artifacts like identity documents and trying to create them in a realistic way that are going to pass the various tests that are enacted upon them. Whereas what Gen AI is allowed now is that essentially anybody can go onto one of the many Gen AI engines and pretty much ask the AI to generate those artifacts for them. And it will generate them to probably a better extent even than some of the human generated artifacts were available previously. The second aspect then that the use of Gen AI allows is scaling up that. So not only are you having a lower barrier to entry with more people doing it, you're also having each of them being able to scale up and create more identities, with the hope that if you throw enough data through the net, some of it will get through.
Right. Okay. But I mean, of course, like you said, it's creating problems and scaling it, but it's also really an arms race of algorithms. AI is creating and scaling fraud, but then AI is also the way with which we can combat it. But I think you clearly expressed what once took expertise and effort is now scalable and cheap. So are we calling this out soon enough? Because some say we are overhyping Gen AI driven fraud. Others say we are already too late in saying so. Are we sounding the alarm too soon or not soon enough?
I would say it's about right. We said Gen AI is scaling up the problem, but the main threat has been systems not being well designed enough or well protected enough to prevent these data artifacts from being used in the first place. So if Gen AI is the message that is being used to help strengthen those systems, then I'm all for it. And I think that needs to happen anyway, irrespective of whether the artifacts that are being input in are Gen AI generated or are copies of real signals, or indeed are human-made fraudulent artifacts.
Right. Okay. No, I mean, we have talked about all sorts of frauds figured by Gen AI. Maybe I just want to now ground things in reality. Can you possibly walk us through any real-world case of AI-driven fraud? I'm sure while working with your customers globally, there would have been some attacks that your client experiences the most.
Yeah, certainly in talking to some of our clients and their experiences in this space, you can see that they're migrating from more legacy methods that involved a lot of human review towards systems that, as you said, are using AI to fight AI. And you know, what we would have seen maybe happening on some of the more human-driven approaches is that, you know, reviewing video calls with people by manual reviews and getting people to maybe hold up identity documents and maybe say a few phrases, the idea that that could be used as a way to prove your identity is certainly not something that is valid in a Gen AI world where such videos can be easily generated. So definitely trying to get to a next level of proof in terms of being able to check the validity of the data coming into the system and the validity of the data being real people interacting in the system in real time is extremely important. So that and certainly that, as I said, using that Gen AI capability, that's where we would see it happening, is in those types of interactions, or perhaps fraudsters in the early days using Gen AI to just generate slight alterations even to their own appearance so that they can try and not have that review team spot that it's the same person entering the system multiple times. So maybe just enough of themselves to maybe get past presentation attacks, but enough differentiation then that allows them to maybe not be spotted by a human reviewer. Whereas when you move away from human reviews to use an AI to actually detect that, those subtleties are no longer gonna make it. And it's that combined with strengthening the systems to prevent the injection in the first place is where modern systems have gone.
Okay. No, I think this is a valid point, and I would at least like a bit of a detailed take from you. And that's what puzzles me. It's not like majority of the institutions are asleep at the wheel. They have fraud controls, like you said, KYC protocols, and also layers of defense. But I still see certain established traditional KYC or fraud models failing to stop these threats. From your experience, what's slipping through these cracks?
I think what's slipping through the cracks in many places is a lack of joined up thinking in organizations, both from a business perspective and across their technical infrastructure. So when you have multiple channels that you allow your customers to interact with, and you're using different products, solutions, and technologies in those channels, it provides gaps then that fraudsters can take advantage of. And I think that's probably one of the big areas where we see failure is where there's no joined up strategy, and you end up with identity silos maybe in a call center versus the digital channel on mobile or digital channel on web, and fraudsters using these gaps to try and circumvent processes. I suppose the good thing is that if you move towards a solution that solves those problems, and what we in Dayon call identity continuity, and being able to have that single view of customer across the channels, you not only cut out that gap that the fraudster can exploit, but you're also able to provide a better user experience for your customers, where they actually feel like they're connected with your organization irrespective of what channel they're coming through, and don't feel like they're being asked for different things and a different experience in the different channels that they're in, that they can actually get a joined up experience of working with your organization.
Yeah. I mean, interesting. This really lends, because traditional KYC treats identity as a static checkpoint, and fraud today, and you clearly stated this, is episodic, it's persistent, and often operates in these between gaps of those checkpoints. And without continuity, even a strong signal at one moment can be misleading. And it raises the questions, what blind spots are most institutions still having into their systems?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest blind spots are these data silos, and these separate data silos, and maybe sometimes not even using data that you already have that you can use to identify your customers, and ignoring it in favor of maybe other artifacts that fraudsters are able to take advantage of. For instance, I observed one organization where they actually had data on file for customers that had been clients for many years, and instead of using that data to verify the user in an account recovery situation, they were getting the user to do an identity verification flow with, in this case, a provider that didn't have a modern system to prevent fraudsters, and were trusting that more than the data that they actually had on file. So definitely this idea of having identity and credential data silos that are across organizations and that aren't being joined up and utilized in a coherent manner is definitely a blind spot I see reoccurring with some organizations.
Right. And I think we have seen this consistently, that fraudsters or fraud thrives in these gaps. When systems don't talk, the fraudsters make the introductions, and at times the that's architecture outpacing integration. Strong individual controls exist, but no connective tissue to hold them together. And when that layer is missing, it's not the parameter that fails first, it's the identity beneath it. And then, at least how I've seen, when you trace most fraud cases back to its origin, it tends to begin with something more fundamental. Most of the times, it's a compromised or a poorly verified identity. And Paul, and of course, what I wanted to know from you is, why do so many fraud events trace back to broken identity signals?
Yeah, so some data from the market indicates that 70% of major fraud losses trace back to weak identity proofing or recovery methods. And I think one of the areas that is important to invest in addition to trying to get that to that single customer view that I mentioned, is being able to orchestrate across signals and methods, and being able to actually have a tool that allows you to create journeys which are individual to the use case and the user that you're trying to work with. And I think that's probably an important thing, is that it allows then, instead of using a common denominator, which is where you get that broken identity signal, where you're trying to get this lowest common denominator that maybe allows you to create one flow that satisfies as many users as possible. The problem with that is everyone is then lowered down to the lowest bar of trust. And if you get a flaw in that identity signal, it creates a problem for everyone, instead of a flow that allows everyone to be proofed at the highest level possible, so that you're only actually going down to that low level for as few people as possible. So I think that's probably one of the main commonalities you would see in fraud, is where actually a lower common denominator signal was being used when actually higher value ones were available.
Right. I mean, 70% is already a huge number, and I think you clearly stated that identity isn't just another component in a security stack. It's the foundation of entire digital experience. And if weak or fragmented, everything built on top of it becomes vulnerable. And one of the moments where that foundation is truly tested, in my opinion, is the identity recovery part of the whole journey. It's often overlooked, but precisely where trust can either fracture or can be reinforced. Now, identity recovery being one of the vulnerable moments in that journey, how do we turn it into a moment to build trust?
So one of the mechanisms you can use to do that, and indeed what many of our customers are using, is using the information that you gathered with them through your previous interactions to then verify the individual during the next interaction. So, for example, that could be that you would store a selfie on file from their onboarding and use that selfie then as part of the identity recovery process to register the app on a new phone, maybe. And if you do that and you create your user journey in a manner that recognizes the customer upon return, maybe, and then actually, instead of the customer feeling like they're jumping through hoops and barriers to get into the system, they're actually having a very smooth flow and feel like they're working with an organization that recognizes and values them and allows them to feel secure in that registration journey, but also feel like that it's an organization that knows them, instead of maybe jumping through a lot of complicated and convoluted steps to try and prove who they are to an organization that they're supposed to already have a relationship with.
I mean, that's really fascinating how this whole identity continuity solves most of the problems, because when recovery is handled with such integrity using biometrics or signals from the previous journey that customers intuitively trust, it becomes more than just a procedural step, which, at least even in my experience, I've noticed in a few banking apps that you hop on from here to there, and you often wonder why they do not remember the previous signal that I had registered with this particular app. And now let's shift to a concept that sits near to the heart of everything we have been talking about today, which is trust, especially in a threat environment that's fluid and often invisible. And of course, trust cannot be static in such time. From your perspective, what are the strongest signals of trusted identity today in such such environment that's fluid and changing in almost every 1 or 2 months?
Yeah, for me, the strongest signals are when you combine signals that cross the physical and digital world. I think we're probably seeing the term "digital" being utilized a little bit to describe that these days, and that's where you're in the identity world. Maybe a signal that is really strong in terms of the digital side of things would be a private key stored in a very secure chip, maybe on a device. But you're combining that then with a physical factor like the biometric attributes of the person interacting with the system. You combine those two things together and you're getting a very strong level of trust in an individual device combined with a trust in the person using that device. And that's giving you a very strong signal to then be able to go and have interactions with that person. You're combining and strengthening that then with additional strength in those signals, like applying device and network intelligence maybe on the device side and real-time liveness on the biometric side, and you're now getting to a system that has multiple layers of signals to establish that trust.
Right. I mean, that really resonates that trust isn't a single point of validation anymore, and it's how you explain the system of interlocking signals from biometric maps to real-time liveness to device and network intelligence. And the strength is in their continuity. And this actually brings me to something we have heard across sectors, the move towards progressive trust. This term has been on the articles, on speakership, on stages. So what I would like to know from you is, how do we build modern identity systems that offer such progressive trust? And I would love to hear how you and your team are building this into real-world implementations.
Yeah, maybe a good example of that might be a customer called Tonic, who is one of our financial services clients. They are using our stack of software to both establish the person during onboarding and then store attributes and authenticators related to that person that they can then use during authentication events. And that could be as simple as maybe what we call our silent authentication, which is a proved possession of the digital device that they registered with. And they might use that sort of device only, which the customer doesn't even see or feel any friction for, to allow the customer to do low risk interactions, maybe a quick balance check or something like that. Then as the customer wants to do more, like maybe viewing transaction history or something, they'll step up to a really simple, easy to use authentication mechanism, like maybe on device biometrics or similar, to be able to allow people to get access to their full account details. Then perhaps the customer then does something that maybe we're seeing as being unusual for them to do. Maybe they're adding a new beneficiary and wanting to send a large value of money to them. In that case, we'll step up maybe to doing a server-based biometric check that allows then an extra level of assurance to make sure that it is indeed that user interacting with the system. So you're getting that sort of progressive layer of additional signals as the user goes through those journeys, rather than having them all unloaded on the customer at once.
Understood. So, I mean, in all of this, there's also this enduring tension, usability versus security. Everybody wants a seamless experience, but of course, seamless does not mean careless. And on that note, can we build systems that earn user trust invisibly, like under the hood, not definitely by hiding security, but by embedding it in ways that feel natural, contextual, and respectful of the user's intent? Can we balance frictionless user experience with deep security?
Absolutely, we can. And I think it's important when considering that you look at what frictionless means, okay? And what we're really trying to do is reduce the friction that the user experiences in the journey today versus the more secure journey that we want them in tomorrow. And sometimes that might mean thinking a little bit outside the box. For example, it could be that in an identity verification flow, we're asking the user to scan a QR code and complete some aspects of the step on their mobile device, which on one sense, you might think that's a bit of friction there. I'm asking the user to change the device and versus staying on the one they started on. But in reality, switching to that device with better cameras and a device that you're able to hold and move around will allow for a lower friction journey with a higher success rate than trying to force the user, keep the user on the channel they started on maybe an old school desktop with a low resolution webcam where it's hard to maybe hold your face or documents up in front of it. So it's a little bit counterintuitive sometimes. In order to get to that lower friction endpoint, you might need the user to do something that maybe doesn't seem very obvious at first. Another example would be contact center, where we're seeing more and more customers now using push to mobile as a way to authenticate users when they contact the contact center. So when they initiate a call through an old plain old telephone network to the contact center, the agent, once they have identified the customer, will actually push an authentication message to their banking app. They approve that, and now the agent has a very high assurance that they're dealing with the correct user on the other end of the phone, is able to continue and handle the interaction with them. And that can be combined with looking at signals from the voice to see if there's any evidence of any fraudsters involved. But certainly having that little switch to go and approve the authentication in your app is much better than dealing with maybe a half a minute to a minute of detailed questions and answers with the agent to try and prove who you are. So again, counterintuitive, you're switching channels, might seem like friction, but actually less friction than the alternative.
Right. I mean, exactly. You've perfectly summed up. It's a shift from thinking about friction as something to eliminate to something to calibrate. And when the system knows the user resistance feels like assurance, not obstruction. In this case, like you said, when the notification goes on the user's device, it feels more like assurance. And of course, now you were also talking about voice cloning in the phone banking space. Paul, in the last few years, if it has taught us anything, it's that fraud doesn't evolve in straight lines. It jumps, it pivots, and often blindsides those playing catch up. From your experience, what market shifts or emerging drivers should financial institutions be paying closer attention to?
I think one of the big ones in the next 18 months will be moving from physical document-centric identification processes through to digital or digital ones. So that means moving away from processes where I'm just taking photographs of maybe documents that were provided to me, identity documents that were provided to me by government, to actually doing more digital interactions with artifacts supplied by organizations, by governmental organizations. So that might be, for instance, I mentioned the digital world, where again, we're using the physical, maybe passport, and then we're using digital verification of that with NFC to be able to increase the trust that that document was indeed issued by the document issuing authority of the country, and that the data in it is valid and hasn't been tampered with. Moving more towards digital-only artifacts, we're seeing a lot of movement now with mobile driving licenses already been released in some countries and many others on the way. So we're going to see more and more of things like digital wallets with attributes such as the EU digital wallet or the new one that's been announced in the UK. Combine that then with a move towards mobile driving licenses. And I think that combined with the use of passwords, passports with NFC, and some of the electronic ID schemes that we're already seeing out there, we're going to see a big shift away from using just taking a photograph of some card, more towards using that combination of physical and digital to be able to validate the identity.
Right. And I think in the beginning also we talked about that we are entering an era where fraud itself is being productized as service kits, AI tooling, even deepfake voice packages, and barrier to launch an attack is lower than ever. And in such an environment, what should financial institutions stop doing and what should they double down?
So certainly I would say what financial institutions should stop doing is relying upon humanly verifiable active checks for liveness and instead actually double down on checks that are actually actively looking for evidence of injection attacks or deep fakes and that are actually analyzing the data coming in and using it for that purpose, because it's now gone to the stage where humans just can't tell the difference. So if you're relying upon that, then you need to stop doing it and you need to start adopting techniques that are more modern. I would say some of the other ones to watch are more in the long term, maybe, are ensuring that you have an eye towards quantum safe computing so that you can ensure that the data or the system that you're building is now is going to be resilient for the future.
Right. So I think one of the takes that I got from you is also that financial institutions still have reliance on phishable credentials. And at least to me, it seems that we have hardened the backend system, but still rely on front door keys everyone knows how to pick. And do you see, because if I look around, there's a lot of buzz around pass keys and they are just going to replace passwords in the coming time. Do you see it happening rather soon, or do you still think passwords would still be lingering around here and there, and it's a bit of a longer journey that we have to expect?
So I think the knowledge factor is going to probably stick around in some shape or form, but not on its own. So I think what the real move will be a move away from phishable credentials. So passkeys certainly have a huge role to play in that. Big fan of them. I think it's the first time I'm seeing a real chance of replacing the password and having the technical implementation there that can actually password. It might not do all the things that some regulated financial services entities wish they would do, but they actually do provide the path towards move away from the password itself. I think the main thing then will be moving away from phishable credentials. So moving away from credentials that people can be socially engineered to share. So a password on its own certainly would be an example of that. Another example would be an OTP, whether that be coming from something sent to a SIM card or whether it be on a device that's supplied to the user that displays it. Anything that's using an OTP is a mechanism that can be used by fraudsters to fish those credentials or socially engineer them from that individual.
Okay, interesting. So, I mean, till now we have talked about fraud, its impact, and how it's denting the system, but also the mechanisms to protect it. But before we go into the final segment, I wanted to understand or have a quick glimpse from you what keeps you optimistic amid all the fraud news and attacks being scalable that you hear. What excites you most about the road ahead in the identity space?
I think one of the really interesting things, certainly for us in Europe, is looking at the EU digital wallet and the infrastructure that's going to bring to bear. It's going to provide some really nice user experiences, I think, in terms of how to securely identify yourself online and open up a lot of opportunities for businesses to gain more trust in the people that they're interacting with. So I think that's certainly one of the ones that I'll be watching over the coming years.
Right. Thank you so much, Paul. I think we have unpacked a lot today. You've outlined how identity is no longer a checkpoint, it's rather a continuum. And as I understood, if we get it right, we create an ecosystem where security feels effortless and trust becomes a user experience itself. And if identity is the gateway to almost every digital interaction, then getting it right is no longer optional. And with that, I'll hand it back to Jessica for the last section. And Paul, and I promise it is an interesting one.
Thanks, Akshay. We'll now move into our favorite last section of rapid fire questions. We'll have you give your top of mind quick answer of myth or reality in a quick one sentence explanation. Fraudsters are mostly caught after the transaction.
I'm going to call maybe myth-ish on that one. So I would say certainly the first time a fraud vector or signal is compromised, yes, there might be that it might take that fraudster might not get caught until after the transaction, but every other fraudster copying that technique will be caught before it, so long as you're deployed with a system that's trying to keep as close to that fraudster as possible so that you can prevent systemic fraud in the system.
AI-generated or deepfake fraud is easily outpacing some current identity management setups.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a threat. The reality is that the fraudsters don't have to play by our rules. So we're trying to play by the rules of GDPR, by the AI Act in Europe and similar legislation in other jurisdictions. So we have to play by those rules. The fraudsters don't. They're able to take AI and they're able to use it to do whatever they want, however they want. So I think that does provide some space for them to outpace industry. So it's up to us to make sure that we're not creating a cross to bear on our backs by going too far in that area. Absolutely, we need to make sure that systems have proper model risk assessment against them, use data in a safe and trusted manner. But let's not put too much admin around that that prevents us from being able to be agile.
Sure. Good points. Identity fraud as a service is becoming cheaper than Gen AI.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. As I said earlier, going from people who had to have skill with various photo and video editing suites to be able to try and create artifacts, or perhaps having to hack things to inject them, to now being able to just find components on the dark web and interact with Gen AI to generate artifacts, it is definitely becoming cheaper for the fraudster to execute attacks.
Okay. If your identity and verification solution hasn't evolved in 3 to 5 years, it's still fine.
I would say that's a myth. Certainly the fraudsters have evolved a hell of a lot in that period of time. So if your system hasn't, then it most likely is compromised.
And I know we talked about this a little bit in the last section, but passkeys will replace passwords entirely.
Yeah, I think I'd love if the answer was yes to this, but I suspect so long as people are offered the option of a password, some people are going to select it. So unless we're prepared to stop offering the option, I think it will be there with the cockroaches at the end of time.
Voice is the most underused identity signal.
I would say little bit of a myth. I actually think strong possession factors are the most underutilized. I think voice certainly is underutilized, maybe in channels outside the contact center. But for me, having strong cryptographically bound possession factors, whether they be passkeys or whether they be trusted devices, I'm still surprised at how many organizations haven't adopted them when they provide such a great potential in narrowing the attack vector for your application.
Okay. And the last one, most identity fraud starts from a trusted device.
So I would say in terms of IDV, that tends not to be the case. It is usually a device that is not trusted that started with an attempt to defraud an IDV journey. And that's actually one of the signals that you can use, is looking at the metadata around that device and trying to see, does it exhibit any risky behaviors, such as maybe being an emulator or things like that. So certainly in the IDV space, as we look at fraud, we would certainly see elements that show that the device isn't trusted. In the authentication space, I would say most modern authentication systems that have the concept of a cryptographically bound trusted device, that's certainly where the fraudster would have to start. But generally, we don't see systemic attacks on such devices. Usually, the vector that the fraudster will use in that case is to try and get around the establishment of the device trust and try and compromise the binding process of the identity with a trusted device during account recovery journeys or similar. And that's typically where they go after, rather than a trusted device.
Absolutely. Well, Paul, I know that Jessica said it's a rapid fire round. I'm just trying to bring a bit of friction into the process of being rapid. You said that IDV, which hasn't probably evolved in 3 to 5 years, is not fine. And I often meet people who say, well, we had it updated during the COVID time when the digitization of the banking was at its peak. And you said, even if it's 2 years or more, that creates an exposure. Could you just tell me a bit more about it? If, let's say, if I establish an IDB system and keep it as it is for 2-3 years, what could be the significant exposure that I would be exposed to as an institution?
So I think something to think about is that during those COVID years, IDV really took off at scale because it had to, because people couldn't go into in person into places anymore. So what that allowed was the adoption of the technology at scale. And I suppose what you were seeing was the technology being used for the first time in many use cases and in many sectors. And equally then, it was the first time the fraudsters needed to handle and try and get around these systems. So what the fraudsters have been busy doing since COVID is trying to figure out how to compromise those systems as they were launched back then. And the fraudsters have figured that out and have certainly figured out how to get data into those systems and around controls. So certainly, I would say any system that doesn't have protection for injection attacks, which most of those early systems wouldn't have had, will absolutely be a target for fraudsters who now have designed systematic and very low cost ways to go and do that. You can literally go onto the dark web and buy kits that allow you to inject various types of artifacts into different types of IDV technology and then go and use Gen AI to create those artifacts. So that certainly, if you're using a system that was, you know, put together back then and hasn't evolved since then, you'll certainly be at risk to those artifacts.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Paul. We are thankful for you taking the time to provide us with an insightful conversation on a topic that we will be sure to follow. Subscribe now so you never miss an episode. We can't wait to share these exciting conversations with you.